Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from: a curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. And we're back after a holiday Thanksgiving break. I hope everyone had a delicious one this year. I certainly had more than my share's worth of multiple feasts, actually. Usually that's what happens over a long weekend. But yeah, what can you do? This time of year, especially right after Thanksgiving, is usually the time when I see a lot of best of lists coming out, and you know, the best cookbooks of the year, the best food books of the year, what you need to get for people in terms of cookbooks, which is what I talk about a lot on the show. So I thought we'd, you know, sort of turn the tables a little bit and talk about the history of cookbooks and what they mean. So I'm really delighted to have on the author of a book, one of the best books of the year, I think, but it is about the history of cookbooks. It is called Food on the Page: Cookbooks and American Culture. The author is Megan J. Elias, and she's right here. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is a monumental work of researching all of American cookbooks. Mm-hmm. So starting from the first one written, what was it, Amelia Simmons. Mm-hmm. How did you find out that this is, and what year was that again?
1796, I think.
So she wrote the first American cookbook.
Yeah, it's recognized as the first American cookbook. It's not the first cookbook published in America.
Okay.
But there were cookbooks published in America that were reprints of English cookbooks. So it's unique for being by an American about American food.
It's about American food. And it's called like American Cooking or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I wonder if she knew that she was making like the first American cookbook.
Oh, I don't think so. No. It's not, and it's not that intensively American. It's it's just that it includes some ingredients like pumpkins that are not English. Right?
Sure.
So
you wouldn't find those in those reprints from Britain.
But she doesn't make a big deal about what she's doing, you know, unfortunately. Right. I know.
She wasn't like, this is local turkey and like we should take pride in it we're American.
No, she was not a locavore, you know.
Okay.
I mean, everyone was a locavore at that time, but not consciously.
I think it's really fascinating that you trace this long history, but also, you know, cookbooks as a book. I mean, not everybody even had access to books going back that long ago.
No, very few people.
So recipes existed in other forms. So maybe notes and letters.
And largely through oral culture. Mm-hmm. Cookbooks were something that belonged to wealthy homes, and they were used not usually by the woman of the home, but by her her to communicate with her staff.
Uh-huh.
So the woman of the house would be literate, and she would read the recipes, and she would then tell the cook, this is what you do.
Oh.
So the women who are, there's a really fascinating gap between the people who are doing the work and the words on the page.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that lasted through, really through the 19th century, people who did the cooking were often not literate, and particularly in the South and enslaved households. Yeah.
Got it. Also, what's interesting is that this whole book really concerns like female history too in America.
Yeah, it does. This is women's literature to a large extent. Mm-hmm. Even when it's written by men, it's about something that women are expected to know about and do.
Wow.
So written, and a lot of the cookbooks that I talk about actually are written by men, but they're even when they say they're a man's cookbook for men, the likelihood is that most of the people who bought the book were women.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a whole phase in the 1930s and 40s when there are a lot of cookbooks that are by men for men, and that actually claim that women aren't good cooks at all.
Right.
That men are much better cooks because they don't have to be concerned with the boring stuff of like making a family dinner every night. They can be much freer.
So men were the gourmands or the epicures.
Exactly.
Telling women what to do.
Yep.
How is that any different from today?
Not a lot. I mean, most of our well-known chefs are male. It's changing. There's more consciousness about women in the kitchen. But, men definitely set the tone. And they have, they have been doing that since the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
But there's at the same time, there's been... this whole kind of stream of cookbooks that run alongside that are all written by women for women, often written by professional recipe writers in places like General Mills, kind of corporate cookbooks.
Okay.
So that's also a big influence, right? And then you could in some ways claim that's male cooking too, because if it comes from a corporation, probably the head of the corporation is a man, but the head of department is female.
Interesting. Yeah. I think that it was interesting to learn that so many cookbooks or part cookbooks were actually like sort of also manuals on household stuff, like etiquette, entertaining, gardening, also cooking.
Right.
And it sounded like very didactic. A lot of these things were almost.
Yeah.
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 This is how you should hold your, like, you know. Control the kitchen, whatever, like pantry.
And it's as you're saying, this is women's history, but it also shows us how much women's history is central to any history.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you open those books and you see that the entire household and everything that could happen to you within the four walls of the household are dealt with, then it tells you a lot about everybody's life, right? Mm-hmm. It tells you that for most of the 19th century, your first medical care came from the woman in your house, the mother figure, whether a grandmother or sometimes a cook, often just the mother. All these cookbooks are full of remedies, and they're sort of non-specific ailments, but that was the first line of defense, was the woman in your house makes you some beef tea or some... what is that thing called? Toast water. It sounds really
It
would cause you to become sick. And those things that...
I haven't heard of that one.
Oh, no? You must try it.
Okay.
Next time you're feeling poorly. You have dyspepsia. You have to have some toast water. So that it's a very different world from the one that we live in now, that your medical care is part of your home.
On that note, you have a section about how there was this movement sort of disdaining nutritional science at the same time that, you know, folks in America were discovering things like vitamins and supplements,
right,
and adding them to processed foods and, you know, mm-hmm, having marketing them on their own. Yet in cookbooks, you write that people sort of preferred the more folksy, mm-hmm, recipes and tonics, I guess, or,
right,
or
right,
solutions to that. Chicken soups, if you will.
Yeah, and that's more kind of mid-19th century and late 19th century. When you get into the 20th century, the cookbooks just drop all of that household stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing about remedies, nothing about making your own pomade, which is, you find a lot in 19th century cookbooks.
Pomade
hair stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the pomade could be made with ingredients that were also culinary.
Oh.
So like there's a lot of blurring
olive
of lines. Olive oil, rose water. Yeah. All kinds of fats. So there's this whole range of stuff that you find in a cookbook in the 19th century that just disappears in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And then it's just about food.
So tell us a little bit how you came to write this book, because your last book had to do with nutritional science, right?
Yeah, my first book was about the home economics movement.
Okay.
And in between that, I've written some other... I wrote a book about lunch, which sort of led me into this more, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then a book about what people were eating between 1890 and 1945. But I got the book about home economics. I had this kind of problem where I was reading all of these textbooks written by academic home economists, and they were about how to cook. And they were scientific, but they were also domestic. And the things that I was reading were actually making me hungry. And
mm-hmm,
I was finding like that there were tasty things in these books. But then I read from our contemporaries writing about home economists, There was this idea that home economists were opposed to pleasure,
mm-hmm,
in food, and that all they wanted you to do was just like eat vitamin pills and get all your nutrition that way. And I never found anything like that in these books. So I thought there's something going on here. And I wanted to get to the root of when that opinion of nutritionists and food scientists emerged, when it was constructed, really.
Wow.
And I found that in this kind of weird moment in the 1920s. There's a lot going on, and that's the moment of the creation of the gourmet in American,
wow,
culture. But it's like all this stuff that I kind of had grown up with, you know, kind of thinking I knew intuitively, like French food is better than American food, and it always has been.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was actually a moment in American cookbooks when that idea was constructed,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't an eternal truth.
Right.
And I mean, if you think about it, it's not true at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be an opinion.
It's opinion.
Right, right, right.
Yeah,
but it was treated as if it was absolutely...
fact.
Yes.
I'm feeling so many, a feeling. Yeah, I'm like thinking of so many parallels to what you're saying with regards to, you know, wellness and new trends now in our diets and so forth. And, you know, sometimes reading some of these intros to recipes and how, or like the cookbooks that are so didactic from another era, it sounds almost comical, right?
Right.
But then I thought of, you know, the Gwyneths and the, who knows what, the fad dietists. I'm like, you know, it's kind,
yes,
of the same thing.
Yeah, I think we're definitely coming back around to,
mm-hmm,
that with cookbooks. The idea of the health cookbook.
Yeah.
That's not just like a kind of outlier health food cookbook, but, you know, for a specific problem that you perceive you have with your body, and you can change that with your food.
Right, and it's a very personal sort of, I am the expert, and it's coming,
yes,
from going to the amateur. I,
right,
love how you summarized cookbooks and what their purpose or what you're looking for in this book. From your intro, if I may read,
sure,
a little bit, you write, when we read cookbooks for what they have to say about national foodways, we hear voices that have long been disregarded, the voices of people, many of them women, who understand that every meal is at once a cultural statement and a performance of self. I thought that was really great.
Yeah, it makes it hard to go, wait, into the kitchen after that. You write something like that. Like,
oh. Yeah. I'm representing something bigger than what I thought.
Right. But you always are. You,
yeah,
know? And it only takes, I mean, you don't have to think about it, but if you just take half a second, you realize that you are always doing something because of something that someone told you, or,
yeah,
that you read, or that
I think
you,
is cool, yeah, or something.
Right, right,
right,
right.
I love, yeah, that. Oh, so much to talk about, but we're going to cut to a quick little,
okay,
commercial break and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
All right, we're back chatting more with Megan J. Elias. She's the author of Food on the Page, Cookbooks, and American Culture. I should also say that you're a professor at Boston University.
Yes.
And what's the course that you teach in?
Right now I'm teaching the Introduction to Gastronomy, and next semester I'm teaching Food and Gender, which is going to be a lot of fun.
Dream job! That's awesome. So I know that you write in the introduction to this book that you didn't want to organize it by like hits throughout the years, but rather by ideas. So, however, what are some of like the really big milestones? Because they're sprinkled throughout there. You know, from the first cookbook, which we talked about by a mysterious person named Amelia Simmons, to Fannie Farmer. Who is this person?
Yeah, Fannie Farmer is so interesting. She was a very enterprising woman, and she started a cooking school. And there's a lot of confusion about what those cooking schools were, because they're not like any kind of cooking classes we have today. They were started as a way to give working class women a kind of like almost pseudo-professional training so that they could ask higher wages for cooking work. So cooking work had always been really undesirable, but you could always get a job as a cook. And if you were a woman, I should say, much easier for them. And it wasn't good work. And these cooking schools that emerged at the end of the 19th century were a way to lift up working class women a little bit by giving them a certificate. So they could say, like, I'm not just a cook, I'm a graduate of the Boston Cooking School. It's a kind of like a ladder for upward mobility.
Okay.
And she's famous for a couple of things. One is that Fannie Farmer was really interested in standardizing recipes, which hadn't been done before. And you can see why if you think that, you know, this is didactic. It's to teach people how to do something a particular way so that their employer can know what they're getting.
Yeah.
So if the employer employs someone who's gone through the Boston Cooking School, they're going to make their chocolate pudding the same way every time, right? So you don't, the employer and the employee have a better understanding of what's expected than they had in the past. And the other thing she's famous for is level measurements, which were, one cup and one teaspoon. What she really did, the way she really changed cooking was that she sold the implements. So before, cookbooks are full of these measurements, like a wine cup full, a coffee spoon.
Of course, a teaspoon, right?
Right.
Yeah, or a tablespoon.
So these things really had a life outside of the cooking process.
Oh my goodness, that's brilliant.
It is, right?
She marketed actual cups.
Yes.
The cup.
Yeah. And so people accuse her of having taken all the fun out of cooking because she took the guesswork out in a way, or took the variety out. But, I mean, I would just say that certainly in my household, no one ever fills a cup the same way. Like one person will mound it, one person will scrape it off. And
it's interesting that people had that response, because nowadays a lot of people I know don't know what to do if there's not exact instructions.
Right.
So to imagine a day when people thought, oh, you just killed, you know, the fun out of recipes by making it too exact.
The idea that it took away the sensuality of cooking, that you should kind of know by feel what's the right amount. And that's okay if you're just cooking for yourself, but if you're cooking for a living, mm-hmm. for people who can easily fire you and you have no workplace protections, yeah. it's good to, it's good to get it right.
Right. So it wasn't necessarily for the home cook then. It was like coming from a professional point
yeah.
of view.
Yeah. Yeah. And guess. That, I mean, yeah. I can never sort of emphasize this enough. Home cooks, they're home cooks you might find on a farm. Mm-hmm. But even on a farm, there were hired girls, and there yes. were also like one's own children were put to work in the kitchen. And in cities, home cooks through the end of the First World War, even through some of the 1920s, home cooks were not regularly cooking meals. A housewife ran her household, but she had someone in to cook the food.
Okay.
So they were professional, although yeah. they were not treated like professionals. Oh, they were blue collar.
So many changes. To talk about a completely different book that is, I think, a bit of a cult book, which mm-hmm. you write about. Later on in the 70s, we see like the politically motivated sort of response to the industrialized food system cookbooks.
Yeah.
We see that there's the Tassajara bread book.
Yes. Yeah. Did you know about that?
I did know about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Such a history. And it's really an amazing book because it comes out of a cultural movement, mm-hmm. right, away from processed food and away from mainstream kind of Anglo culture in America. And it's, you know, it's the perfect place that it comes from is from a Zen retreat mm-hmm. that had, before it was a Zen retreat, it was just like a resort. And so it had changed from this kind of decadent thing uh-huh. into a Zen center. And this man who'd gone as a cook, just a regular cook when it was a resort, he changed with it. Mm. So he took up Zen and kind of added it to his food ways at the same time that the center did. But what I love about the book is that it's it gives food a voice and a character, and it gives you the responsibility to, as the cook, to connect to the food and help the food achieve its best self, kind of, to use contemporary language.
Yeah.
So it's a really, really kind of silly scenario, but also very heartfelt. And mm-hmm. And it's also full of very traditional recipes, too.
Yeah.
So it's not all tofu and soy sauce, which wasn't really traditional for his audience, who are, you know, middle-class Anglo people in California. But it's got coffee cake in it, and it's got, like, peanut butter and kind of ordinary
it's
American food.
It's the strangest book, but yet it's like the reflection of a time yeah. and a people
yeah,
and what they
beautiful.
Ate. It's really interesting. And also a return to making bread from scratch, right? From naturally yeast leavened processes.
And using whole grains, and it changes the aesthetic, or it's part of a bigger change in the aesthetic of bread. So what had been valued for a really long time,
Wonder
like hundreds
bread.
Of years, mm-hmm. white bread was mm-hmm. seen as better than brown bread. And you only ate brown bread if you couldn't afford white bread. And it completely flips that and yeah. says you're a sucker if you eat white bread. Only, you know, the smart people know that whole wheat mm-hmm. is like the most delicious thing. And it's virtuous. So it's like it's good for you. It's good for the planet.
It's alive.
It is, right?
Organisms that live in this, you know, dough.
Yes.
It's true. And you see that, you know, continue with mm-hmm. cult hits like the Tartine Bread Book and,
right.
and so forth. Now, Modernist Bread.
Oh, yeah.
Which is such a huge book. I don't even know what to do with.
Yeah, can you imagine fitting it in a little kitchen?
Yeah.
It'd take up a lot of the room, more than the bread, probably.
Right. One thing that's interesting is that there was an explosion of cookbooks after the Civil War.
Yes.
About Southern food.
Yes. Yeah.
What was this? What, how did that? Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think it happened. This is my argument, and other cookbook historians agree with this, that it's part of the white Southern attempt to reclaim cultural dominance and political dominance in the
no
South.
No kidding. Yeah, right. That makes sense.
So it's some people call it the lost cuisine, to go with the lost cause mythology that the South lost the Civil War, but they had a noble cause. And you see this argument repeated again and again in cookbooks. You see this persistent and disgusting argument that Southern cooking was better with slavery, and that you will never taste how wonderful Southern food was.
What?
Yeah. And unless you could go back in time And now, you know, you just can't get good help.
But isn't that saying that, you know, the enslaved cooks were much better cooks than we are?
Yes, but so the way that they phrase it, and this is a kind of familiar argument in other situations too, is they're naturally better than us. That's what they're meant to do, is cook for us.
Wow.
And so we just don't have the skills. You know, poor white people, we just can't get in the kitchen and make things, you know, make the magic. There's a lot of talk about black magic and mysterious arts and stuff. It's, these books were really stomach turning. I mean, I felt like, you know, the recipes, if you cook them in your kitchen, they might be delicious, but the ideology that's putting them on the page was just repellent.
That's and very odd, too, to, like, make an admission. I don't know, whatever. I don't want to get into whatever mindset those folks are in, but...
But I think it's, like, now, I think more people are noticing it now in the how we talk about Southern food and Southern hospitality, that we're kind of we're going back and digging under that, the way that we're sort of taking away Confederate monuments. It's time to do that with the cookbooks as well. Yeah. I think
it's a turning point. Yeah, that's really exciting. So, where do you think American cookbooks are headed now?
Oh yes, I mean, the ones that I see just physically are bigger.
It's true.
So there's these great big bricks that
are more
beautiful.
Expensive.
Yes. And there's like one picture on a page and then one recipe. I think they're headed in a really interesting direction because they have to compete with blogs. So I don't know what that's going to look like. I mean, I've been waiting for the digital media and cookbooks to kind of meet in a way that they haven't yet.
They tried, but it didn't really work.
Right. There's not like...
ebook or cookbook wasn't just... didn't catch on.
Right? It doesn't like... You'd think it would be that you get your e-cookbook and it comes to life.
Right.
And it talks to you.
You can see a video here and then you can hear sounds of what this should sound like when you cook it here. Yes. I don't know.
Yes. And maybe a chat with the author or a chat with someone who just ate the thing that was cooked. But the multimedia opportunities haven't come to be yet. So we still have like big, beautiful, delicious looking cookbooks and then wonderful blogs and wonderful recipe sites. And nothing that bridges it.
Right.
As far as I know. I mean, I may not be paying enough attention.
A cookbook is still very much a cookbook.
Right.
Meaning it is still a book.
And I keep meeting people who say, oh, I have thousands of cookbooks. And, you know, I love them all. I never cook from them, but I love to just read them in the evening. And I think that you're never going to find digitally, that the reading of cookbooks, the way that we read novels or the way that we read fantasy in particular. Yeah. Like, I'm going somewhere when I get into this, when I get into one of those Otto Lengi cookbooks. I'm like, I'm off somewhere else. And it doesn't matter what I'm really eating.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's still got legs. It's, what, 200 years old?
Right.
So now we look forward to seeing perhaps a sequel to American Cookbooks from Megan J. Elias in the future. Well, that's about all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I suggest anyone looking for gifts, for people who really like cookbooks, this is a really great book, Food on the Page by Megan J. Elias. All right, out from Penn Press, University of Pennsylvania Press. All right, thanks everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Never had no loving like this before.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.